Welcome to the No Film School podcast. My name is Ryan Koo. Today we're going to celebrate a decade of DSLRs. As a proud sponsor of both the 2016 Sundance Film Festival and the No Film School podcast, Canon USA would like to congratulate and celebrate the filmmakers behind the camera. Canon Cinema EOS, go wherever the story takes you. Sundance is the premier film festival for feature-length independent films, but for short films, it's also My Road Reel, the world's largest short film competition. Presented by Australian film company Rode Microphones, the competition is kicking off for its third year shortly. Register your interest at myroadreel.com. The Canon EOS 5D came out in August 2005. Over 10 years later, at the 2016 Sundance Film Festival, I hosted a panel celebrating a decade of DSLRs. I wrote the DSLR Cinematography Guide, which is available for free at No Film School, because of the Canon 5D Mark II. So I was excited to host a great panel, including the DP of the Oscar-nominated stop-motion Charlie Kaufman feature film, Anomalisa, the DP of the TV show Portlandia, the director and DP of Queen of Versailles, and the senior film and television advisor at Canon. Now, as part of the event, we rolled some clips, many of which you can find in our associated post at nofilmschool.com/podcasts. The main point is the takeaways and the discussion of craft that we have with the DPs. This was the third panel of the day that I had done at Sundance, so please forgive the shape that my voice was in. My name is Ryan Koo. I am the founder of the filmmaking website No Film School. I'm also a writer and director. My forthcoming feature went through the Sundance Screenwriters Lab. I'm very excited to be here, not only because it's Sundance, but because my own experiences with the DSLR proved to be quite instructive, I think, for how popular it got. I was, as a cinematographer, interested in the 5D Mark II for the video, and I found myself spending a lot of time on forums trying to figure out how to make this thing into something resembling a movie camera ergonomically. And as a result of all that time, I decided to write something called the DSLR Cinematography Guide, which we gave away for free on No Film School. And it has been downloaded over a million times now. So obviously a lot of people shoot with DSLRs and have gotten a lot of it out of it. I know nothing about these cameras, however, compared to our panelists, so I'm going to introduce these directors of photography and directors. The first is Bryce Fortner. He is the director of photography of Too Legit and Portlandia, as well as With Bob and David. And then we have Laura Greenfield, who is the director and photographer on The Queen of Versailles, which won the directing award here at Sundance in 2012. Tom Hurwitz has 133 IMDb credits, I believe, including The Queen of Versailles and Nothing Left Unsaid, Ghost of Abu Ghraib, Our Brand is Crisis, and 130 others. And we also have Joe Passarelli, who is the director of photography of a currently Oscar-nominated film, Anomalisa. So then Tim Smith, the senior film and television advisor at Canon, who has seen everything in the last 10 years that there is to see. So to get started, I think we should start at the beginning of each of you, how you first came to pick up a DSLR, what your initial impressions were of it, and whether you were coming to it from film or some other passion or medium. Let's just go down the line, starting with Bryce.
First time I actually used a DSLR was, believe it or not, I was on the pilot of Portlandia. It was a 7D and the T2i. It was a really small crew, it was myself and an AC. I operated a camera and so did he, and that was it. And we had two people on Grip and Electric, and we shot it in 3 days. It was very interesting. I'd done a lot of low-budget stuff, so I had a lot of experience with like HVX and things like that, but I also had experience with a lot of experience with film. So it was interesting to be able to shoot with something so small that could get such a filmic image, and we could shoot with such a tiny crew that we literally had one AC and an operator and myself make it possible. It wouldn't have been possible on anything else, honestly, and not had the same look.
I am still a photographer and was long before I became a director. So I started with Canon, I don't know, at least 15 years ago, and was an explorer of light, have been an explorer of light for Canon. And so I've been using exclusively Canon cameras. So I came to use the DSLR because I was already using the camera. I had my big transition going from film to digital in 2004, and the Canon people kind of helped me through that transition. But then once I was on that I've always used that DSLR, and so it was just kind of this amazing bonus when you could shoot high quality video with it, because I was already lugging it around everywhere.
I was working in a kind of an odd netherworld. I mean, I was working in large format in some projects, and I was working in small chip video on other projects. And it was, a lot of you probably don't even remember this period, but it was a period where digital video had been introduced, but good, really high quality digital video didn't exist. There were some things we liked. We liked HDV. It came out with, especially the Sony products, came out, had a kind of a painterly look that was good, but it wasn't giving you the resolution that we knew we were going to be needing. So the 5D came out. It was adopted by lots and lots of people across the board, and I didn't like it at the beginning. And I didn't like it because although the color seemed to be great, the width, the size of the chip itself, the taking chip, was simply too big for documentary work. And it tended to make people rely on a very small depth of field as a way of doing composition. So the compositions became kind of striking because everything else was out of focus, but at the same time, a little too easy and kind of seeing the same kind of thing over and over again. So I was kind of slow and a little distrustful of it, but there were some things that the cameras did that nothing else did. Like you could go on a plane and shoot with them and nobody would bother you. Or you could take it. I was in Tahrir Square during the big revolution in Egypt, and everybody with the big cameras was getting their heads beaten, and I was walking around with a 5D, and it was just fine. So I was kind of moving up to it, but the coincidence was I worked with Lauren Greenfield on Queen of Versailles, and Lauren was just loved Canon, and I loved Lauren's work, and I loved her color, and so I began to investigate Canon products and really kind of get into the quality of their images, and I was just never stopped being impressed by it, and it was making me feel like I didn't need to be nostalgic for film anymore, and then I came to Sundance with Queen of Versailles, and Tim was standing there outside of the film office in headquarters with this new funny-looking camera that looked perfect. And I said, "How big's the sensor?" And he said, "Super 35." And that was like, yes. And I took a look at it, and I took a look at the image and the ergonomics of the screen and the way the whole thing was set up, and I pressed it to my shoulder and it stuck, and I said, "This is it. This is the tool that we've been waiting for to raise the quality of our images." And that's when I adopted.
Joe?
My first experience shooting video on a DSLR was probably right after I got out of film school in about 2006. I went to AFI. When we were studying, we mainly shot on film, or at the time, kind of the what we learned about were kind of the high-end digital cameras. And after I got out of AFI, you know, I had to go look for jobs, and I was getting hired on some short films. And, you know, at the time, there was kind of, for lower budgeted stuff, there was other video camera options like the HVX200 and all the different options out there kind of had these fixed lenses with these third inch chips, which kind of made everything in focus. And it was really hard to get a cinematic look. People were trying to put still lenses on top of those lenses, and it was just really complicated. And I was doing this one short film, and the director had just got a 5D. And, you know, they were like, "Well, let's try shooting video on this." And they were showing me stuff, and it was kind of the same thing. It was the exact opposite of the video cameras at the time, where everything that was being shot, particularly video, was like kind of portrait style, where it was like one thing was in focus in the foreground and then everything else was blurry to try to like overtake advantage of that new kind of, you know, you can shoot video with kind of a filmic style depth of field. So, you know, using that and seeing the difference, it was, you know, an interesting process, because, you know, you can take something that's made for still images and then try to incorporate it into what movies are supposed to look like. And it just seemed to work. And I use it a lot. And then the C300 came out recently, or a couple of years ago, when I started using it. And that was a huge game changer. It definitely felt like a more cinematic camera, kind of kept going with the same path that all the other camera makers were going with at the time.
And so the question is probably a little bit different for Tim, because the first time he picked up a DSLR, did DSLRs exist? Did you make?
Well, first time I saw the 5D was before it really existed.
Yeah.
And you have to understand, and I thought, I'm out of a job. I thought, I'm done. Because I have 25 years with Canon, but I was with the video division, which was had nothing to do with the 5D. We screamed at development saying, you know, we want bigger sensors. And I know that our plan is to make smaller sensors. The smaller the sensor, the bigger the zoom. And isn't it going to be great to say we have a 30,000 power zoom, but if I make a big sensor, we'll have 3 power zooms and nobody wants those. And I thought, I'm done. I was invited to Denver by the camera division because I was the video guy. While all the camera people were going to be trained on the still side. I sat through 2 days of training on a printer that, you know, had more inks than I can imagine, and then the still stuff, which I thought was interesting because obviously I love photography, but motion was my thing. Then with maybe 10 minutes left in the day, one of our marketing people who had a 5D in his room last night played video directly from the camera out to the screen that we were looking at, which was him pulling focus, even though he didn't know what that phrase meant, from his phone on his desk at the Marriott to a Coke can on the other side of the desk. And it just went like that. And I thought, I'm done. The camera division is going to put the video division out of business. It kind of did, actually. I mean, we're still in the video business, but we changed our whole business model to be a professional products group. So finally they said, well, we're going to put the 5D in Tim's bag. And it's been paying my mortgage ever since. So anyway, yeah, I thought the 5D was the end of my career, and it was the beginning of some of theirs. So,
well, obviously, we were all using 5Ds for so long, but when you went to the C series, that must have been in development and in planning for a long time. What was that transition like?
Yeah, fine. Well, that when we decided to get into the C series, and we understood that we had something here that filmmakers would. We'd already reorganized the group, and we were focusing on filmmakers, and we knew we were going to roll out the C series. So I got involved in the C series before it came out, and we got to make a bunch of films for the big rollout, and that I thought was also going to be a game changer when I saw it. And the moment I remember on that one was we had shot some test footage, which was just an over-under test. And it was a cinematographer, wonderful cinematographer named Richard Crudo. He's president of the American Society of Cinematographers. And he shot this over-under test. And it's a picture of I'm holding the card saying, you know, +1, +2, normal, things like that. And I'm the subject matter. And I race over to Technicolor to see it on the big screen because I was doing something else. And I opened the door. And there's my head 40 feet high. And it said normal, which is odd for me. But I was just stopped. Like, I'd seen all the specs, but I'd never seen the image. And I just stopped. And we walked with the engineers and with Richard. We walked right to the screen, like right there, and just started staring at this image, trying to figure out why it looks so spectacular. And we didn't really know at the time that we had developed this way of creating, of dealing with the noise in the sensor. The noise in our sensor was non-fixed pattern noise, which our other video cameras didn't do, meaning that the noise was never in the same spot. It moved, and it gave it that grain look, that film look to it, which was never in any of the pre-trainings of the tech specs. They told us latitude, and they told us color, but they never mentioned that this is how they had decided to pull the image off. And we knew we had something special at that point, too. So the 5D was maybe a happy accident for video, but that was intentionally designed by our engineers to have that moving grain look in it. It was as close to something, I wouldn't say it was close to film, but it was as close to a filmic experience that I'd seen from an electronic image.
Well, we can talk about these things abstractly, but we have a lot of great clips to show. So, Bryce, I think we're going to show a clip from Portlandia Season 1, if you'd like to introduce it.
Sure. It's the, I think it's the scene where Fred and Carrie are ordering the chicken at the restaurant. And
We all know it.
Good. We shot that, Season 1. 3 cameras, all of Portlandia was, after the pilot, was 3 cameras rolling all the time, wide shots and close-ups on everything, which was a challenge. But anyhow, so that's what we're about to watch. Then Season 1, after the pilot, we went to 5D for everything, and we were on EF still lenses, the 24 to 105 and the 70 to 200, I think.
Number of cameras, lighting consideration, ISO and those things. Tell us how you did it.
So again, every scene we shoot, I shot on Portlandia was with 3 cameras, always starting with the wide shot and always starting with the close-ups at the same time. So like in that time, we had the wide shot, the 3 shot with the waitress and Fred and Carrie, and then Fred's close-up and Carrie's close-up were going. Then after a couple takes, I moved in and I got the close-up on the waitress after they kind of figured out where they were going with the improv. ISO, I mean, that was probably 5 years ago. So I know the range that I stuck in, but I think that was in early days too, where there were some theories that it needed to be at 160 and other theories that it needed to be in multiples of 200 and all that other stuff. And so there was like like early days of all that stuff. Plus we were shooting with the neutral look in the camera. I think the neutral with like contrast turned all the way down and saturation turned down. And that was it. We were just really trying to figure out what the heck we were doing. And again, we were a super tiny crew. The example I always use of how quickly we move on the show is like season three, which was a C300 season, but it was season three. We had 45 days and we had 276 locations. So it's like six locations a day. It was kind of the average on that show. That's the average. There's sometimes, I remember one day we had Roseanne Barr. She had to be done by lunch. So we shot 10 locations with her before lunch. It was insane. I mean, it's not all company moves, but it's you know, pick up, load down.
And moving at that speed, especially with comedy and the way it affects performances, did you have the 5D built pretty small and you're very agile?
That was another thing too. It's still early days of accessories, you know, so we're just trying to figure out like how to accommodate these things. Like, as much as I love the 5D, it was a definite challenge to make it, you know, video friendly. And we're doing a lot of long takes, a lot of handheld takes. So that show is 98% improvised. Like that scene is basically just like Fred and Carrie order food and the waitress brings the thing and that's it. And then all the dialogue, all the stuff is just completely improvised. So we have to roll three cameras. So just in case Fred does something once, we don't want to have to make him try and do it again. And we shot everything on location, all practical. So having something as small as the 5D, if we could strip it down to just the camera and a lens, then we could do that. Which is another reason we shot on the 24-105 and the 70-200s, because they had the little built-in stabilizers. So they got rid of the little jiggle that you'd get if you were just holding the camera and the lens. And we also, lighting too was super tiny because we have to move so fast. We didn't have any generators. So our biggest light was a 1200 watt HMI. Everything had to be able to plug into a wall basically. So it was, I think we had one image 80, like three Kinos and a 1200 watt HMI. And that was season one. I mean, like it's crazy. Very small run and gun show.
Well, you did such a good job that you got more seasons, and we're going to watch a clip of season three as well.
Sure.
I want to introduce that.
Sure. This is from season four. I was mistaken. Okay. It's from season four. It's called the Celery Incident. We shot on C300s. And it was really fun. It was, again, this is all shot with three cameras. It was shot in a day and a half. So same, very small considerations. Our budget went up a little bit, so we had some bigger lights, but everything you see is pretty much shot three cameras all on location. Season four.
Let's take a look. But my question is what the transition was like. How long were you shooting on DSLRs, and then what did you find you were able to accomplish with switching to the C series?
We shot the first two seasons of Portlandia on the 5Ds, and we got to know them pretty darn well. But then when C300 came around, Tim and some other folks did a demo at Portland, and it instantly sold me on it. The big thing was just the size of the camera didn't change very much, but it was also just the latitude was that much better. I mean, as you could see in season one, there's some latitude issues, and you know, it was just nice to kind of just like have a camera that was kind of on your side, you know, I guess. I also really grew to love, as we started to use it, just to be able to shoot it extremely, what I considered extremely high ISOs. I mean, remember back in the day, it was just like on film, 400 was as good as it got, you know, and now on that, we would regularly shoot at 4,000 ISO regularly. Especially when you see it broadcast in like really high quality, it's like, I challenge most people to honestly pinpoint the grain. I don't see it. So I mean, with the ability to shoot at 4,000 ISO just makes so many things possible. So we could still do that run and gun style that we had on Portlandia, but suddenly, I don't know, just it kind of opened up the world for sure. And the internal NDs helped us move that much faster too. And speed was obviously so quick on that. Cause again, we had Buscemi for a day and a half and just, we had, I don't know, 10 locations or something on that. So it's just a lot of locations, and we're trying to pull off a cinematic look. And
so just to jump in for a second, you're 4,000 ISO.
Yeah.
If you get a chance, come by Main Street where you can see our camera that shoots at 4.5 million ISO. So 4,000 ISO was so like 10 years ago.
What was your pre-production like? It, you have so much going in a day, but there also seem to be very planned moves. Is it, you know, in conjunction with so much improv, how much like shot listing were you able to do and know when you were going to?
Zero. Okay. We would get a shot list from Jonathan, the director, on the morning. And I also probably 95% of the time I would see a location for the first time on the day. And that was the same with the celery sketch and the chicken sketch. You just walk in and be like, all right, I guess this is where we're shooting this thing. And so another reason that we couldn't really rely on having a big generator to tow big lights, we needed stuff that was small. So if we could walk into a place that all we had access to was wall power, then we needed to be able to make that work. I will say the one thing that I did miss from the 5D was its 12-minute cutoff point, because we do a lot of, it's a lot of improv. And so season one and season two, we'd cut off after 12-minute cutoff point, that'd be the end of the take. Season three, four, we'd be doing 20, 30, 40-minute takes. of just pure improv, and that was handheld, and we were just like,
you didn't have to tell him.
Yeah, I know. We debated, but once John was smart. Once he realized it didn't cut, he just kept going.
Yeah. What did you do for In Front of the Lens, class-wise?
First four seasons, even the celery sketch was on EF still lenses. Two ACs for three cameras. I operated A camera, and then another operator for B and C camera. And all the operators pulled their own focus. So we needed to be small, we needed to be nimble, and just like really quick. And so we stayed on the 24 to, when we went to C300, we went to 24 to 70, just because the sensor was smaller, and I wanted to shoot at a 2.8 instead of a 4. But we stayed on the 7200 and the 24 to 70 when we went to C300.
And what was the overall speed of production? How long was the season?
45 days was, season one, we shot the pilot in 3 days, and then we shot like the other five episodes in maybe 17 days or something. I mean, it was crazy. But then after that, it became 10 episode seasons, and they're about 45 days.
All filmmakers, it doesn't matter if they're working on a major motion picture or a small indie, have one thing in common, a desire and a need to bring the images on the big screen to life. For decades, Canon has been committed to developing and engineering the most pristine optics to solve filmmakers' creative and technical challenges, because Canon understands that it all begins with the lens. Learn more at glassfirst.com. With more than 2,000 short films from 89 different countries and close to 500,000 in prizes given away to date, My Road Reel is the world's largest short film competition. Proudly presented by Australian film company Rode Microphones, the competition is kicking off for its third year shortly, which promises to be its biggest yet. There's a huge prize package and an international judging panel of recognized film experts. To find out more, to watch films from previous years, and to register your interest in this year's competition, visit myroadreel.com.
Let's move on to Lauren and Queen of Versailles. I believe we have a clip which was shot on 5D Mark II.
Yeah, it was mixed, and Tom Hurwitz was the DP for Queen of Versailles. So at the time, it was before the C300, and so I was shooting with the 5D stills and then also second camera, and Tom was shooting with an ENG camera, which at the time for Verite documentary, you couldn't really use the little cameras for. So in this scene that we're going to show, it kind of bounces back and forth, and just I'll give you a little bit to set it up. The story was about a family that tried to build the biggest house in America. It was a 90,000 square foot palace inspired by the Palace of Versailles in Orlando, Florida. And the husband was a timeshare billionaire. And when the financial crisis happened, it became a kind of supersized foreclosure story and an allegory about the overreaching of America. And the house was kind of this white elephant, kind of this symbol of the mistakes that had been made. And so the scene you're going to see is at the end of the film, when Jackie knows that the house has gone into foreclosure and that they've made mistakes and should have been happy with what they had.
One of the great talking points for the big house was that you could see the fireworks from Disneyland every night.
Right, so they were selling it because you could see the fireworks, but so at the end of it, when all was kind of lost, I wanted to go shoot this view when the house was abandoned. And so we decided to go there at night, and it was kind of in ruins. And we got there, And they had never seen the fireworks because they had never been there at night because they hadn't moved in. So we get there only to find out that the fireworks are so fucking far that we didn't have strong enough glass for it. So I think we had a 300. So I was like, we have to put this off. This is not going to work. This is just too far. We did the wide angle shots. And then I called Canon and was like, send me the 600 as soon as possible. And then we got that and we went back. But it was very symbolic because, of course, this dream house with this incredible view that was only Disney World ends up not even being a close view of Disney World.
So with a 90,000 square foot house, I guess you weren't choosing the DSLR because it would fit into the space.
No, I mean, actually, one of the things we loved about making that film was we were filming them over a three-year period, and they were incredibly open with us all of the time. But part of it was because sometimes when you're shooting Verite and you're like four-person crew, you feel like giant and like you're taking over somebody's house. But even in the 26,000 square foot starter mansion where we were most of the time, we were like part of the help, and there was a big, big group of help, and so we would walk around virtually.
But getting
unnoticed.
Smaller as the economy crashed, the help got smaller.
But they were used to having non-family members around, so it was kind of like, okay, here's my family, here's my camera crew. And there was one time we were at David Siegel's birthday, and the guests started talking into Tom's camera like we were filming the birthday party, saying, "Happy birthday, David."
So with the four-person crew, you each had cameras, but what was that like?
Well, so the thing that was great for me about working with the 5D is that I am a photographer who became a director. And one of the things I loved about being a director was not shooting and collaborating with people like Tom, who could kind of take the way that I saw the world and interpret that for me with the Verite experience that he has. But it's still, and I liked having that, being able to back off and have that 360, but then I was always kind of antsy also to have a camera. So I would pretty much always have a camera and either doing stills or doing second camera. And that was the thing that was very liberating with the 5D, was this ability to have multiple cameras. And there have been other situations, like commercials. I did one for Gatorade where we mounted cameras all over the ceiling for basketball games. So that was just really appealing, that the way we could be so small as still photographers, we could then use that as in making films, and also the ability to have multiple cameras.
Were you shooting, did you just have a lot of CF cards on hand and you were just rolling a whole lot and that was what it was like, or?
Well, since I'm a photographer, I always have a lot of cards. So, we just have a ton of cards, I guess.
And what was the other format?
We were shooting tape.
It was tape, yeah. It was the Panasonic,
school.
It was the HVW-900. Was that, did I get the letters right? Anyway, it was a financial decision that got made. But anyway, it was a pretty usable digital tape format that I could get in there and fix the color on as well as I could and make it look good. And it came out beautifully. Actually, the film looks great.
And the C3, when did the C300 come out? 4 years ago.
Yeah. Came out when we were here at Sundance.
So when we came to Sundance with the Queen of Versailles, it was just coming out. And so before the C300, I could shoot still lifes or a little bit of very limited work or a second camera on an interview with the 5D. But you really couldn't shoot Verite with that camera. And so when the C300 came out, it was kind of this revelation. We were like, if only that was out when we were doing Queen of Versailles, it would have been kind of amazing. But the next clip that we're going to show is C300, and it's from a series that I've been doing on the rich in China since 2000 called The Bling Dynasty. And it's a mix. What you're going to see this clip is a mix of photographs. And then last year, I went back to China for the first time to shoot film. And the clip that's in here is about the Chinese learning how to be rich. And so it's a class where you pay $16,000 for a 2-week class to learn how to be rich.
Some beautiful off-speed there, which we would not be able to do with the 5D Mark II.
That's certainly true. I want to say a few things, technical stuff about it, but the first piece of it is that kind of one thread that runs through my career, and there are many threads, but one of threads is shooting dance. My mother was a dancer, and I've been working shooting dance since George Balanchine. But I have never been able to do what I was able to do here, which is to be right on the stage with the dancers and do it on stage. I'd done it in the studio, but I had never been able to do it on the stage. Part of it because I couldn't control the lighting the way I controlled it here, but also because I never had a camera that was small enough that I could really work that close with the dancers. And so some of that stuff that you saw was handheld. Some of it was done on a Movi stabilizer rig. It was the simple existence of the C300 that allowed us to work like this. So the technical stuff is that there hasn't been any color work on this at all. On my own work and on when I can convince producers, I don't shoot in C-Log. I don't shoot in log format. I don't do it on Alexa either. I bake in the look. And this is a tough sell in a documentary, But I do it because I want the editor and the director, when they're in the cutting room, to look at something that they enjoy looking at, as opposed to looking at something that's flat and gray. And if you've had the experience of looking, even with Rec 709 or LUT applied or all the other LUTs that we can apply, unless you have somebody color correcting, essentially color correcting your dailies, which you can't do on a documentary, you're looking at ugly footage until you get to the color correct. And I think that affects the way a film is cut and the attitude of the people as they're cutting the film and the choices they make, because they don't see the way the light works, the edges of the light, and they don't see the way the color vibrates, the way red comes out. Canon red, I mean, they can't see it until we get to the color correct.
Looks great. Last but certainly not least, Joe has Anomalisa, and a little bit different, obviously, since it was stop motion, right? Which camera did you use?
Yeah, it was Anomalisa is a stop motion feature, and we shot on Canon 70s. We're starting out shooting. We needed something small, obviously, because it's miniature sets, and we also need something that really good quality and something that kind of work with the animation software. So we tested a bunch of different cameras, and the 70 worked out the best, mainly because of its chip size and just the resolution of it. And I think this is the trailer for it.
So the 70. How did you choose that camera of all the DSLRs available?
Mainly because of the chip size. We were trying to find something with a smaller chip. It would work better with our depth of field. Just because with miniatures, you end up having to get the camera so close that with the bigger chips on the DSLRs, it just would make you know, trying to keep everything in focus that much more of a challenge. So then we kind of landed on the 70, and we had a wide array of different types of lenses. They all had to have a manual iris on them. And then as far as kind of the technical specs of it, I shot everything at a 200 ISO, and for depth of field, we were trying to keep kind of a, like when we started out to get a look for the film, we wanted it to look real, like all the puppet designs and props and everything were supposed to be realistic, but kind of through camera and lighting, we wanted to add kind of a cinematic value to it, kind of like make it more of a dramatic piece. So I was trying to keep everything in like a 5, 6, or an 8 range, which in stop motion doesn't really give you that much of kind of wiggle room. And then as far as kind of the shutter speed on it, that's the kind of advantage in stop motion, because you can just basically pick whatever shutter speed you want at the time. But, you know, kind of through testing and stuff, it was interesting. We started to find like little variances that would happen. If you'd have a 200 shutter, it might, or a 2 second exposure, it would give it a different feel than if you had like a 1/60th shutter speed. So all of that kind of went into that. And we kind of, after, you know, a lot of testing and everything, almost everything was shot between like a second and a half and a 4 second exposure on everything, just because it kind of gave a little softness to the image. And because not much light's getting in there, we had like everything dimmed down really low, so light wasn't spilling everywhere. And on that, and as far as kind of the look, the, you know, lighting it and stop motion, it was such a long process, it's a 2-year process. So we wanted basically everything to look on set as close as it was gonna be to a final product. So we kind of tried to strip down the canon. We shot it in neutral just to kind of give not too much like, you know, color correct put into it, because all cameras kind of do that. There's some type of a look that every camera's got, and the 7D seemed to have a neutral look, so we would kind of create the look with like lighting and gels and everything on set versus kind of doing it in post and kind of make sure that that look stayed the same from when we shot it on set. And when visual effects get it, we need to make sure that it all kind of always had that cohesive look to it.
Do you know the final count of how many frames she shot?
I think it was like 178,000 frames or something like that.
How many frames did you do a day?
We had 20 stages set up, and each stage was kind of boxed off in a black area with a camera and a set and an animator. So there's 20 of those, and at each day, about 10 of those sets were being animated. Each animator did anywhere from 24 to 48 frames a day. That's what they say they really did, and most of them got like 10 or 15 just because it was so, like, the movement was so small and the face replacements, like, you know, because it was still low budget. So animating like this, it was the faces were printed on a 3D printer, so you could take the face off and put another face on, and then they would take a picture, and sometimes it wouldn't register because there wasn't really a registration for it. So the animation process was pretty long and drawn out, which the over 2 years using 20 different 7Ds, I can attest that like those sensors are very solid and very, you know, consistent over time. Because it's pretty amazing. Like, you know, we'd have problems with lights, you know, starting to burn out. They would start to get brighter. The, you know, just wood would start to warp over time and the set would start to, you know, change. But the one thing that was always consistent was the sensor. It always kind of took that same picture day in, day out, and we were just waiting for one to just eventually not take any more pictures, but surprisingly they all made it through the project.
And it was continuous lighting?
Yeah, it was all, you know, we would light the set to, you know, be what it would look like on screen. So, you know, we built small lights, and the thing with the small lights is our homemade ones, we'd make lights out of light bulbs and stuff, but if you turned on a 40-watt light bulb full power, it's actually pretty bright and the light would go everywhere and it'd be too hard to flag. So we'd have like 25-watt light bulbs dimmed down to, you know, just about where it started to get too red for their faces. So it was like you'd walk on the set and it'd be like you can barely see anything, and then you'd look at the, you know, you'd look at the monitor and you'd be like, oh, okay, because we had like a 4-second exposure, so it looked different from in person to on camera.
And how did you deal with the camera moves, stop motion?
All the camera moves were motion control, but, you know, when we set out, we wanted it to look like a live action film, basically, like a dramatic piece. So, you know, every time we did a motion control shot, there would be, you know, we would just run through the move and, all right, it looks too mechanical, program a different move. It looked too mechanical. We just kept going until we kind of got that, you know, live action feel. And me and most of my lighting crew mainly does live action. So we would, you know, we kind of knew what it was. And the animators had a different point of view on the camera moves than we did, because it would be like, oh, no, the curve of the motion control thing needs to look like that. And then by the time we were done setting up a move, it would be all over the place. It would speed up, it would slow down, and it would tilt down, and sometimes it would go out of focus. But that was kind of what we were kind of going after.
Well, I think that's a great time to open it up to questions, because Anomalisa is certainly, it's a wonder to watch and brings up all sorts of questions in your mind as to how you pulled it off. Do we have microphones in the audience, or should I just repeat?
So I just saw on Queen of Versailles, there was this interview shot where you zoom in and out to get the focus consistent. I've never been able to do that on DSLR. Like, what
stuff
did you
use?
It wasn't on a DSLR.
So the shooting with Jackie was on the Panasonic, and then the still lifes were on the DSLR. And that's exactly why, because with Verite, it would have been impossible to shoot.
I mean, still, you know, you get good at it, is all I can say. And seeing, because I'm adjusting the focus as I'm zooming. And you know, it's funny. I haven't used a live zoom like that in 4 years.
But now that you're shooting with the C300, what zooms are you using for Verite?
I don't use a zoom. I use the zoom lenses as variable focal length lenses. But if I want to go in on somebody, I walk in. Because I'm using lenses that don't have smooth zooms, and I've kind of taken that as it's just a change in my style. This, to me, when I saw this, I was happy at the way the zoom looked. It looked graceful, but I just realized I don't like that anymore. I don't like a camera. The zoom calls too much attention to itself.
So with the C300, you're using EF lenses or
I'm
cine
using
lenses?
EF lenses for the most part because of the weight and the variability of the focal length.
And a lot of that's based on the construction and the design of the lens. When you're using, say, the lenses which were primarily designed as still lenses versus the lenses that were primarily designed as cinema lenses. So, you know, and then it depends on different worlds. I mean, Bryce will probably, you know, you would probably be all cinema lenses at some point, maybe, I guess, for season three and four.
Season five actually became cinema lenses. Yeah. So the first four were EF still.
It changes the way you can approach some of that, too. And it's really comes down to money, too.
So. On a tripod, I mean, I use one of the Canon CineZooms. Because they're wonderful lenses.
But with the 17-120 zoom, you could get a zoom like that, a smooth zoom.
Yeah, you could with a 17-120. That's right. It's a little heavy out there to carry for all day.
And it's not for the faint of pocketbook either.
I'm just curious about how Canon is approaching an open source platform. I think just recently there's the Magic Lantern that does a hack for the Canon 70Ds and Marks, whatever. And they were just funding on Kickstarter to have an open source camera body. How is Canon approaching that kind of new market, I guess, where there's going to be more freedom for frugal cameras, like cheaper end cameras? Like, what do you think the direction of that is?
Magic Lantern is kind of interesting because, I mean, you use the word hack and you'd think as a company we'd look at hack and say that's a bad thing. But it hasn't been a bad thing for us because a lot of the hacks that they've sort of developed have then become features in our cameras. There's only kind of been one hack at one point that was a problem for us because they were taking the camera and running it at frame rates much higher than the camera was designed for, and service was having burnt out processors and stuff like that. But for the most part, all of their hacks actually were kind of product development for us. I would say chances are somewhere between zero and what's below that. it just doesn't fit in the business model. It would be, you know, it's hard to say that. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking about the last 10 years because this is based on the 10 years. And everything that's happening on this panel was not foreseen at all. None of it, none of the animation. There's a C500 on the space station doing a documentary right now, circling the planet. That comes out on IMAX film April 29th. That certainly wasn't in the playbook. I think when it was actually developed, we may have had Greenfield in mind. She was, at the time, we used this terrible term called a hybrid, where she was this well-known still photographer who was shooting motion, and now, obviously, she's just well-known as both these days. There's no more hyphen. You know, we thought about that a little bit. There was also this one moment in a meeting in New York with somebody you know who I won't mention, who had said to me, Tim, stop getting so excited about this camera. The video portion of the 5D, we expect to add about 5% to our sales. It's the wedding people and some news people. And it's like, I think I need to update my resume. You know, this thing is going to just take over. And it did. So I would say anything is possible. And we are definitely open to that. And the one thing I will say for my company is things like Blackmagic are good for us. Things like the Blackmagic camera with an EF mount on it is awesome because we make so much money on lenses that if it's got our mount on it, we're very happy with that. Red's got the Raven coming out with a fixed EF mount on that, and people think, oh, what's Canon think about that? I think profit. So yeah, we're very open to all of that. So if it did make sense and it would move forward what the needs of a filmmaker are, I bet you we would do it. But it's not happening now. So,
I wanted to know. I've been a Canon shooter for quite some time, and with some of the competition that's coming out, whether it's Sony or Panasonic or the Reds, can you speak on any new developments, new cameras, anything that technology that Canon's got in mind for future cameras?
Can I just grab a piece of that first?
Yeah,
because I try to look at all those cameras. I try to continually, as each one comes out, I take a trip to Abel Cinetech in New York, and I do the test, and I take a look because I don't want to get self-satisfied, and I want to make sure if there's something. And here's what I feel. It ain't about the resolution. It's about the color. It's all about color science. I want an image that has real depth and color, and there is nothing that looks out there that looks, except very, very, couple of very, very high-end cameras, way, way, way stratospherically beyond what the Canons cost, that 12-bit Canon color looks like. It is just wonderful. And I mean, as long as they keep doing that color thing, I'm going to keep using their cameras.
And then more specific to your question about whether or not I'm going to announce here to the world what our next camera is. No. But I will tell you that, I mean, if you go to our space and you see a camera sensor that can do 4.5 million ISO, and you can now see the C300 Mark II, which, you know, I hear, oh, I love to shoot at 4,000, or, you know, it's all about the latitude, or it's, you know, the new one's 15 steps of latitude, and it's 4K, and it's got 2K 12-bit, and it'll shoot 120 frames a second in camera. So, you know, we're always going to be doing this, but we're also a lens company. And that's the thing that when you mentioned the other companies, they're not lens companies. They're electronics companies. And because we make lenses, and because lenses have such a long shelf life in terms of development, sales, profitability, we can put money into the research on the cameras as well. So, yeah, we're going to constantly be, you know, but I'm not going to say it here.
Also, Tim, on the new cameras, when you shot the 4K C500, you had to have outside.
Right, on the 500.
In order to shoot raw.
Yeah, no, on the C500, in order to record 4K, you had to have a separate recorder.
But hasn't that changed now?
Yeah, on the C300 Mark II, you're recording 4K internally. Now, for Tom, he still may want to go to 2K because he can get his 12-bit, plus you'll be able to get 120 frames a second without a recorder as well, where in 4K, you're 10-bit max with a 30-frame max internally. So there's a lot of options there. But for like your show, which is, I don't know if they mandate 4K or not, but you go 2K 12-bit, the color information you get plus the flexibility of the frame rates, it might be the thing. You know, there's that trip to Portland I was asking you about.
So now you have much better slow motion in the new.
Yeah, I can do 2K 12-bit up to 2K in camera up to 120 frames a second on the C300 Mark II to the card. So
we have time for one more.
Oh, I have a question in regards to the DSLR. Are you guys getting rid of the compact flash, or is everything going to SD?
Compact flash is older than everybody on this panel. So yes, it will go away at some point. But but the two formats that will exist will be SD and CFast. CFast more so for the high resolution type of stuff. I think that areas at CFast, our new camera is CFast. At some point, I'm guessing you'll see CFast on the SLR side, you know, still at some point. But CFast is the next, that buys stock in CFast.
Okay, well, Bryce, Lauren, Tom, Joe, and Tim, thank you all for coming. And thank you.
Thank you for listening to No Film School's podcasts from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival. This was our last one. We are finally done with them. I hope you've enjoyed them. Be sure to check out our other Sundance podcasts, including with the director of photography of Miles Ahead, currently in theaters. We have podcasts on documentary cinematography. I did one with 4 Sundance Screenwriters Lab fellows. We talked to Kickstarter's film lead, Dan Schoenbrunn, whose own anthology film, Collective Unconscious, just premiered at South by Southwest as well. Plenty more episodes, all available at nofilmschool.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening.